Greetings and welcome to Libraries Lead in the New Normal podcast. This is our fifth podcast of our second season. Hello, with our learned but fun-loving lineup of Beth Potan, assistant professor at Syracuse University School of Information Studies, Mike Eisenberg, founding dean and faculty emeritus of the University of Washington's iSchool, and me, myself, and I, David Lankus, the Bowden Professor of Librarianship at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you for listening to our Libraries Lead podcast. Please keep spreading the word. Send us feedback at info@librarieslead.org and review us on your favorite podcast app. It helps, and you know, we have fragile egos, so it helps us. And we're very grateful to our academic sponsors, the University of Texas High School and the Syracuse University High School, and as always, Ace Chicago Events. Hi, Beth. Hi, Mike. Hey, Beth, please remind us, why are we here?
Hi. As we've been saying, the last 2 years have been hard on us all, and it seems like there are some life-altering, transformative changes taking place. We talk about various aspects of life, work, fun, and what are or might be the unique roles and opportunities for libraries and librarians to help people in this new normal. Our podcast runs approximately 1 hour, and it includes a what's up from each of us, a deeper dive into a main topic, and as always, we end with our awesome library thingies. So let's get right to it. Dave, what's up with you?
Well, this has been a good week. I got to go home I got to go to South Carolina. I don't know where my home is anymore. And see my wife and my dogs and my boys and spend some time because in transitioning to Austin, I'm here on my own for a bit. And while I was there, I was feeling really cocky about my wonderful choices as the South Carolina state legislature was going to take up a piece of legislation to remove tenure from the university system throughout. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, only in South Carolina. And then yesterday, our assistant governor, our vice governor, I don't even know what his title is, said something to the effect of his number one legislative priority will be to get rid of the tenure system for all the universities in Texas as well, because of course we are just liberal off the edge teaching different stuff. And by the way, if you do have tenure, you'll be grandfathered in, but if you teach critical race theory, you will in fact be eligible to have your tenure revoked. So, you know, it was a lovely week in terms of that, and I think it's an interesting setting for our conversation today. So there you go. What's up with you, Beth?
So I'm in Alabama right now, and my mom is recovering from surgery. And today it was my cousin's, she was admitted to college. She's turning 18 in a couple of days. And so it was her admitted student day at the University of North Alabama. And so I got to get up at 6 a.m. and drive her, you know, about an hour and a half to her first college, you know, admitted student day. And it was, you know, we all spend all of our time on college campuses and have for like decades, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but we can't go back to being a freshman. And so it was really fun to kind of watch that experience through her eyes. But also as I'm like listening to the president talk, I'm like, yeah, whatever. And like, cause I know the whole university so much better than when I did when I was a freshman, I guess, the whole system. But it was, she got to go on a tour of like the nursing department, and they practiced CPR and learned how to take people's blood. Doesn't even seem like you should do that at an orientation. So I'm not sure, but I was encouraging her to ask questions. And the only question she had is, does the dorm have a curfew? So I think she's ready. I think she's ready. So that's what's up with me. I got to take her to experience that. And it was, you know, it was really pretty fun. I enjoyed it. Mike, what's up with you?
Oh, that's great. Yes, I've had that experience with my grandkids. I know Dave has a few years ago when he went around with his kids, but I've gone with my grandkids. And with COVID, we've been doing virtual tours of various schools. My granddaughter, who's actually visiting us here right now in South Florida. It's great to see what we're so familiar with and comfortable with through their eyes. And I'll just say it reminds me And I used to describe when my wife walks into a hospital, well, when most of us walk into a hospital, we're intimidated, we cower, we are. And when Carol walks into a hospital, she just starts, you know, she's home and she's ready to boss everybody around and tell them what to do. It's kind of like that with us at universities. Yeah. A lot of people are very intimidated at universities, but we're not. The other what's up with me is that everywhere I turn, things that we've talked about in this podcast, like the new normal, like the changing nature of work, like mis and disinformation, are everywhere. And I think we're on the right track talking about these things, and particularly tonight in talking about censorship. And maybe it's appropriate that today is President's Day that we are actually talking about this particular topic, because I do think that our nation and republic may be in danger. So that's my what's up. And we're going to take a short, collect our thoughts breath and come back with our main topic, which is Revolutionary War inspired. The censors are coming. The censors are coming. And with that, we'll take a short break and be right back. Yanni, bring up the music. 3, 2, 1. Okay, and welcome back onto our main topic, which is quite serious, which is the censors are coming, censorship and book banning. It is happening here again. There's a huge increase in efforts to censor what is taught or even discussed in schools and libraries, along with banning, and in some cases, even burning books in schools and libraries in the 21st century. In this episode, we delve into the nature of these threats, along with ways to counteract them. The same people who pretend to be pro-freedom and against the cancel culture and wokeness and safe places and hurt feelings now want to censor and ban books, pass laws against teaching about race or sexuality, and to protect our kids and ourselves from ideas, science, or history that might upset them. What is this all about, and what are the implications, particularly for libraries and schools? In 2020, more than 273 books were challenged or banned, states the ALA, an ALA release. That number is down significantly from the 377 logged in 2019, but for an obvious reason, many libraries and schools were closed or moved online for much of the year. So the numbers are up. And this year, we've seen the number of challenges skyrocket, and the media coverage of this increasing as well. For example, Texas State Representative Matt Krause called for the state school libraries to review a list of 850 books for possible removal. And we're hearing about cases like this all around the country. ALA won't release the 2021 numbers until National Library Week in April, but you can be sure that they're up there. But we're also hearing stories of libraries and educators fighting back. Like in response to Krause, librarians formed the hashtag FR Freedom Fighters, FREADOM Fighters, to resist what they call a war on books. So Beth, what's going on? What triggered this new round of censoring actions? And are they real threats to libraries, schools, and society?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is very serious. And I think in terms of like educators, librarians, parents, concerned citizens, this is something that we should all be taking seriously. I want to take a step back, though, before I really jump into what I think about this and give us a couple of definitions, because I think that one of the things that I see happening is so often people kind of conflating some of these terms. So I want to take a second and break this down according to ALA. So first, they define challenge as an attempt to remove or restrict materials based on the objectives of a person or group. And challenges don't involve just somebody saying, I don't like this book, right? This means like an actual attempt to remove the material from a curriculum or a library. And that means restricting access from other people. And that is, and if they are successful, then that is a ban on the book, right? If the challenge is successful, there is a book ban. One of the things I see happening in these conversations is saying, well, it's available elsewhere. And so they kind of define the ban as like, well, if you can still get it on Amazon, then it's not actually banned. And I would say that that's not true because it's still restricting access within that community. So censorship is another term that's really getting talked about a lot. And that is really us changing the status, the access status of a material by some governing authority or its representatives. So thinking about that as an official challenge. And this includes the exclusion, restriction, removal, or even grade level restrictions. ALA would define even a grade level restriction as censorship. And then this kind of larger idea that we talk about, intellectual freedom, which is one of those foundational rights that librarians believe in, the right for every individual to seek and receive information from all points of view without restriction. And so I think, you know, I wanted us to take a second to kind of pull those terms apart and at least using, we could probably spend a whole podcast just arguing about those definitions, but just using ALA's definitions for simplicity. Why is this happening? So that's what is happening. So now I'm going to answer your question, Mike. Why is this happening? We are challenging books that talk about bigotry and oppression and hate. And we are doing it intentionally because we don't want our children to talk about those things. Emily Knox has been interviewed a whole bunch about this. She published a book in 2015 that was about banned books in kind of the modern age. And she was recently interviewed by Slate. And I want to quote her because I think she's really on to something about why we are challenging, why we're seeing this happening right now. People are trying to get books like Mouse banned because they're afraid that if their children read them, they will have different values than the values their parents want them to have. That's what this is really about. People are looking at the books as dangerous knowledge. In the library field, we say we never know how any individual person will react to a book. But people who ban and challenge books collectivize everybody. They say, well, I read this book and it disturbs me, or my child will read this book and they will be disturbed. And so it's really this idea of kind of, you know, they're going to be changed by what they read. And they're not wrong. You know, I think to some extent, they are not wrong about that. Right? Like, books do change us. We've all been changed by a book. And so that is, I think, one of the things that makes this kind of tricky. They're not wrong about that. What I think they're being really tricky about is saying what they want to ban, like the case in Mouse of saying that it's about nudity when it's mice. And so like mice don't wear clothes. So the idea that the nudity is the problem is really like smokes. I don't know. I forget what the right word is, right? But they're like trying to fool us. And that, you know, but I think the idea that they're worried about their kids having different values than them, I think Emily is really, Dr. Knox is really onto something with that. Dave, what do you think?
Well, first, since we're in clarifying stuff, let's be really clear that I was talking to someone the other day and they're saying, well, you know, particularly with you're in Texas. And I said, whoa. I said, yeah, we've got our issues. And, you know, it's easy to say South Carolina. It's even easier to say red state and ideological. But if you look at those challenges and you look at those bans and you look at, by the way, discussions of changing curriculum and changing reading and what's allowed to be reading, et cetera, it is nationwide. It is north. It is south. Yes. It is east. It is west. It is red. It is blue. And yep. While we can certainly talk about people's reasons for it. The notion that it only happens because Republicans don't want us to hear about brown people. That's one. There are plenty of other people that have, you know, there's lots of historical fiction that really does a poor job of representation of diverse communities. And so the question is, should those be available to children mm-hmm. in guided areas? You know, I'm thinking back to the days when we were talking about filtering. Well, we now filter websites and such, but there was a law called, what was it? Was it SIPA? It might have been SIPA.
Yeah.
But SIPA. It was the idea of what had to be banned. And the idea being that, you know, we had to prevent people from accessing different information and such. And it's all about, once again, this idea of protection. And what really drives me nuts is we create this sanitized, ideologically interesting area where children are in the area of maximum teaching and support and conversations. And then they get home and they get on iPads and they get on their phone and they do whatever they want and no one's monitoring it. And so the idea that they're never going to encounter these ideas as long as they don't get it in the school library is just lovely and hilarious. I want to be clear that when we talk about freedom of access to ideas, there are plenty of idea restrictions for what people feel is a good reason on all sides of ideological spectrum, sure. on all sides of geography. The other thing, though, that I think is really interesting is when The Guardian did a great piece when they looked behind a lot of these community-led efforts to ban materials and books, they found out that, in fact, it was much less of a grassroots situation and much more of an astroturfing situation, yes. where while there might have right. been local interest in doing this, they really keyed into national networks of people funding these kinds of challenging, funding this. And by the way, very much The Guardian looked particularly around the right-wing side of this. But it is the same group that was helping the idea of mask mandates and anti-vaccination. And so it was sort of a piece that was happening. That's what frightens me is the organization that goes behind this. Challenging right. books for a long time. I mean, we've always challenged books. We've always had ways of processing it. It's the idea of it becoming increasingly organized and funded as an effort to make this happen that kind of frightens me. And it does. And the other thing that, so as I was thinking about this, and I was kind of like, I've got to do something. I am a professor of library science. I must do something. And I called several of my colleagues, and I was talking with Christian Zabritsky, the director of OCPL, and a friend, and we were talking about it, and I kind of said, what can I do? And he goes, Dave, he goes, don't take this the wrong way, but what we don't need is a lot of sort of stolen valor, where people who want to get the attention for saying something, you know, get up there and talk about it. What we need to do is support librarians who are encountering this on a daily frontline basis. He said, if you want to know yes. what a library science professor can do, a library science professor, a scholar, whatever, can go advocate that we pay librarians what they're worth, that we realize that the role of a librarian is less and less about organizing materials and more about mediating conflicted communities together. I mean, the school librarian, I talked to a public librarian at relatively new in the position, very small, rural library. And she was like, I'm terrified. I am terrified that, you know, the first challenge that comes in, what's going to happen and how that's going to be perceived politically and how that can impact my life and can impact the people who work for me and sort of frontline trauma of suddenly fighting a community that you've been told to serve. So, you know, you can hear it in my words, which is it's a complete jumble. But what I worry about is while we sit and worry about the finer parts of this and finding the that's on both sides and all this other stuff, there are people who are organized to make this happen that do not have that level of self-reflection. And it's making a larger impact. I mean, we're not quite sure, for example, how many of these things are successful? How many districts are we talking about? Is it just because the news has decided this is the cool thing of the day? I don't think so, because legislatures are involved. But I think that particularly those folks who align with the library philosophies of freedom of access, that align with the idea of, the way to counter bad speech is with more speech, the idea that a citizenry governs itself must be informed across all of the different dimensions, we need to do a better job of being organized. And it comes at a bad time, and then I will shut up, I promise. The bad time is that libraries, and we've had a conversation on this podcast, have really been moving away from the idea that they're objective and neutral and to the idea that they are active in their communities to make them better. It takes one of the sort of really safe standard lines that the American Library Association's used for 100 years of freedom of access, which is we are objective and we are neutral, and therefore we collect all of this stuff. And now we can't sort of say that and at the same time say, and we're here to support multiple voices, and we're here to you know, be advocates within a community. And so, like I say, it's a bad time because we need to get our message straight right now. And it's not as easy as it used to be. I don't know, Mike, what do you think?
Well, both of you have given so much to unpack that I'm going to back up in a minute or two. I want to just point out, just for information, OCPL, the Onondaga County Public Library. Is that right, Dave? So and Mouse is a book about the Holocaust, right, Beth? And yes. Just so that our listeners they probably know this already.
And from earlier, it is Lieutenant Governor Daniel Patrick of Texas for my WhatsApp. So
I was going to say Lieutenant.
Okay. Yep. Okay. But I do want to also point out that this is not just in the United States, that we are seeing these same kinds of things worldwide. And, you know, the repression and censorship, and I'll use that term purposely, in China, and control of the internet, control of what people say. So this is a global issue because we're a global society now, and we're all connected. I also would like us, I'm going to park the question of what libraries and library and information educators can do for a couple of minutes and talk about this, because I think that what you said about helping people on the front lines and in the field is really important. It comes back, my very first job, actually it's my second year of my first library job, which was in the Syracuse area. I had moved to the high school. And in my very first year, I had a challenge to a book, and I was accused of harassing a student. What had happened is there were two books that were challenged, that they called up the principal and whatever, and I freaked. And so the first thing that happened, I happened to be walking through the library later that day, and I saw a young lady, probably a 17-year-old reading one of those books. And I stopped and I said, oh, how do you find that book? What are you enjoying it? Is there anything about it that's upsetting to you? And she said, no, it's okay. It's nothing great and whatever. And I continued on. I said, okay, thank you. And I continued on. Well, it turned out that was the child of the mother who had complained about the book. And the child still had the book, which freaked me out and whatever. But I was accused of harassment. So then I went. I didn't know what to do, and I didn't really know too many people in the area. And I turned to the library school in the region, the Syracuse University School of Information Studies. And there was a meeting of librarians in about 3 or 4 days, and I went to that. And they really helped me, and they supported me, and they calmed me down. And they said, we have rules and approaches and procedures to deal with this, and you have to take each of those one at a time. And go through the process. And yes, it slows down, and it's not a process meant to just throw red tape up. It's to calm people down, and there may be a decision not to house the book or not to use the book, because there's a big difference in K-12, first of all, among the levels, but there's a big difference of whether something is required in a class and right, available through the school library. And that's a really big difference. And, you know, there is an appropriate place for selection at both levels. You select books for use in the English classroom or social studies. You know, I used to do book talks in content classrooms around assignments on history or science or even art. We would go in and I'd do a book talk of 15, 20 books about artists and things. But those were optional. They were not required reading. Students could choose what they want. So those have different criteria for selection than a classroom that decided to read a certain book for a historical perspective. And I think that's one area that we can really help, and that is to make sure that the professionals, classroom teachers, administrators, school librarians, and of course, academic and public librarians, have procedures in place and a policy that's well-written, well-articulated, that helps them to cope with this. And it does not become, you know, a screaming match, which on Twitter or our favorite platform, Facebook. So that's kind of where I come from the beginning. I also think, Dave, your point that the organized nature of this, that's happened before. That happens in cycles. You know, a certain political group will decide that, you know, this would be a good month to drum people's ire up, and we'll ban books. And, you know, the same language is used, the same objections, the same list of books. And of course, most of the people, or many of the people who lodge those complaints, have never read the books, certainly have never read them completely. And that's one of the things that's usually required in a procedure and a policy on considering books that are questioned. So, yeah. And then coming back to you, Beth, I would just also add for you, you know, what about the efforts on the left to also make sure that inappropriate books that stereotype or in particularly disparage certain groups are in fact not part of curriculum? And how should we handle those as well?
Yeah. So a couple of things. One of the things that Emily Knox also said when I was reading her article is she mentioned McKinn County in Tennessee, where they banned Mouse. And she mentioned that then the next day it came up in Oregon. So I think both of you just touched on like how social media is exacerbating this as well, because like now it's so easy for us to get that they made a list of 850 books in Texas. Well, we can share that with everybody. And now every state has a list of 850 books, right? So we're seeing that social media aspect of it, or and how they can even organize. Mike, that's what you brought up. But what is the name of this county? Where is it? McMinn County. But in that county, and with the case Mouse, they had policies in place of what to do with book challenges. And that governing board decided not to follow them. The school board didn't follow the policies the library had in place. And everybody on the board also admitted that they had not read the book, right? So like, you can have policies in place, but like, if they don't care about that, then what happens? And so like in this case, right, we're seeing the librarians organize and the parents organize and showing up to the school board. And we even see some of those librarians stepping up to run for different offices for some of the city seats and seats on the school board. And so we are seeing this, these things becoming motivation for political action for librarians, which is really interesting. And that is maybe to Dave's point of the organization behind it. We are kind of seeing that on the librarian side too. And, you know, we should bring up every library again because they're, you know, great people to support this work that's happening. Mm-hmm. So Mike,
let me just, point, I just want to, you're absolutely right that sometimes the librarians and even the classroom teachers and the school's advisory committee is about to implement, and the principal or administrator or the school board goes ahead and overrules all that, which is, again, inappropriate. But teachers and librarians, you know, worry about their jobs, and also in this internet day and age, worry about harassment and and threats to them personally.
So, well, and sure. What we're seeing is, you know, I have many teacher friends. They're now new proposed legislation and regulation where teachers have to submit a year's worth of lesson plans before they teach them so they can all be reviewed ahead of time and things like that. And I think context matters here because we saw that, for example, in the Virginia governor's race, the GOP candidate talked about being the party of parents. And it was successful, at least the, once again, all the media and such looked at that as a primary success for winning, which was the idea of not teaching critical race theory and parents having control about what's in the classroom and all these other things. And so, you know, there's the cynic in me that says, ooh, it worked there. Let's see where else we could use this. There's also the amplification.
But it also worked there, Dave. I just have to interrupt you just a bit because the Democratic candidate really misstepped by saying, well, we don't care what parents think or whatever, which is not true. Educators, of course, care what parents, and actually you need to think about all the parents and not just a loud vocal minority or whatever.
Right.
And so I think it is true that the issue of parent control played a major role there, but part of it was just a total misstep, I think. You said, shooting yourself in the head.
Yeah, when you look at the context, McAuliffe basically said, we have experts for that. You know, in essence, we support our teachers in doing this. But that's much more nuanced of a conversation. And frankly, it's the one that we all hold in this group. And so we have to be really clear of our, you know, what's in front of us, which is we've trained librarians to do this. We believe in them. They set up these processes. And it's like, oh, that's great. Boy, what a great, thoroughly thought through process. Could I get five people to vote that we're going to completely ignore it? Yes, I can. Mm-hmm. Next. Right. And so, you know,
right.
What I'm worried about in the context, and Beth, you put it beautifully, which is, you know, books make us uncomfortable. Yes, right. I mean, it's kind of like it's sorry for this really horrible analogy. It's like trying to be on a diet and being told, you know, food's the problem, but you can't cut out food, right? You say, right, and learning's the problem. But you can't cut out learning and education and what people learn from these things, and so. You know, the hard part is, I mean, the end of the sentence that the Texas legislator sent out, one of the ending sentences was, by the way, can you identify any other books that would make students feel uncomfortable? And the answer is hopefully every damn one that we have, because that's what education is about. It's about expanding people's perception, which is uncomfortable. When I mentioned at the top, when Lieutenant Governor was talking about the idea of tenure and tenure systems, this idea that, you know, we want to be able to have greater control of what we're saying in these areas and, you know, who's allowed to speak of what. And you know, what was it? He goes, we don't want students to walk into a classroom environment where they automatically feel like they're being told that they're the oppressors and they should basically feel bad and we can't start it. And honestly, I'm okay with the idea of students coming in and going, look, this is the history. This is where we are. If you feel bad about it, that's your choice. But I really would hope you do something about it instead. You know, critical race theory is not about going out and making people feel bad. It's about trying to deal with systemic injustice to create a better society. And so is that an uncomfortable conversation? Yes, it is. Did people get thrown in jail? Yes.
But
did people get lynched for that? Yes.
Also, they're not banning critical race theory books. Like, let's not kid ourselves. There are no critical race theory books in these school libraries, right? That is a complete farce. Like, are they banning Derrick Bell? They're not, right? Because he's not in their library. They're banning Black history books. I want us to be very careful about not conflating those things because they're getting away with this by calling Black history critical race theory. And so to Mike, to your point on the left. So I hate To Kill a Mockingbird. I read it when I was a kid. I've read it a few times, probably. It is not my favorite book. It has nothing to do with the language. And this is what I would ask us to think about. Why are we teaching To Kill a Mockingbird? Like, what is the goals of us discussing this book in a literature class? The goals of that book, and I write about it in my work in the Epistemicide book, right? So like, this is a story I think about a lot. The goals are for us to examine our relationships with race in society and the legal system, right? That is the goal of talking about that book. So one, I'd say if we're not willing to talk about those things collectively as a community, then we shouldn't read that book anyways, right? So that is why we read the book. But two, if that is what we are talking about, race and culture and the legal system, why are we only reading like a white Southern woman's perspective on race and legal stuff? And so to me, that is the way we fix this in the curriculums is like, yeah, you can read To Kill a Mockingbird, but like, let's also read Walter Dean Meyer's Monster, or let's also read, you know, a Lesson Before Dying, or something by Ernest Gaines, where he's talking about the legal system as like a Black person in that same time, right, that she would have been writing To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. Like, that to me is the way that we challenge these materials, is not that we don't talk about them or not that we don't have them on the shelves, but that we're building these balanced collections so that we can have these books in conversation with each other. And to me, that is the danger of what we're losing. And you know, if I get to pick, I'm not reading To Kill a Mockingbird with any people, because there's a finite amount of time and I want to spend my time on books that like I like, right? And that I want to talk about. But that doesn't mean that I don't think there is a place for it. I just think its place is within conversation with other items. And
so maybe now,
and I can the, say the, yeah, go ahead.
Maybe the silver lining is that the so-called To Kill a Mockingbirds are being questioned as to their value in curriculum. If you're going to choose a book to raise the issue of race and the legal system and prejudice, that what are the other choices? So the it may be highly appropriate right now, and that perhaps the censors are in some ways, who knows what they will reap at the end. It may be even more revealing and appropriate.
But yeah, the problem is that the sorry, go ahead. The problem is that we're making the same arguments. Sorry, that literally, Beth, the argument you just made is the exact same argument about, Mouse, if it's just in a school library, it's not being taught in a class, and what context, and I'm not there to have the conversations, and not right. And so the problem comes down to then back to intentions, but it's also that notion that at the end of the day, if we had honest discussions about this, is there an acceptance that being uncomfortable and being challenged in one's perception is an essential and important part of the educational process? One, that's the school library side, is important for a community's development and dialogue as a community. There's a public library part, is important for future everyone, which is, future professionals and careers, which is the academic. You know, if we, and what's interesting is that at a high level, we can all agree, we're all about trying to create a really important conversation about this. And Beth, I'm coming back to your point, which is, yeah, but if you go underneath it, there's a difference between saying this is not necessarily the best, most authentic way of feeding that conversation versus I would rather avoid this conversation altogether because it's uncomfortable. And so, as you said, that there's that 9-page itty bitty type spreadsheet is full of trans, is full of LGBTQ text, is full of Black history, and it's not critical race theory. It's the idea of I don't really want to have these conversations with my child, or I don't want to be put in this conversation because I don't really like the part that I get to play in this.
I think there's also this conversation about like, whose harm do we care about? Because like, if we're going to let kids read books with racial stereotypes and slurs, and we are all for that, then like, let's not pretend we are pro parents or we care about kids. That is really explicit about who, what parents we care about and what kids we care about. And I mean, and as somebody who's grown up in a public school system who had to read To Kill a Mockingbird and Huck Finn and got to watch my teachers and all my classmates say slurs in a way that it was okay, like, it's, you know, it's damaging. I went to a high school where we had slave auctions to raise money for our dances. We would have slave auctions. You could buy each other and make money for your class. And then that person was supposed to do whatever, you know, the person that bought them. So I freaked out about it because, of course, because I didn't keep my mouth shut in high school either. And you know, and but this is really right, like what is comfortable. And my chemistry teacher unfriended me like 5 years ago because I brought this up. And she's like, it's really not a big deal because, like, you know, we say slave all the time, like I'm a slave to my clock. And I was like, let's not pretend that we weren't like actually buying people and making them do stuff. Like, and she's like, well, I did that and it wasn't that bad. And I was like, yeah, okay, but were your ancestors enslaved? They fucking weren't, right? And so like, right. How are you gonna tell me how bad that hurt? And so like, as sitting there as somebody in that classroom reading that book, how are you gonna tell me how bad that hurts? But like, at the same time, we wanna spare other people's feelings, please.
Yeah, I'm gonna, we've got maybe time for one more comment each, and then we're gonna have to tie it up. The one I'm gonna use is, I'm gonna quote from a woman named Tina Deskovich, who is a leader of the Moms for Liberty, which is a conservative group that seeks to enshrine parental rights into law. And she was defending Governor DeSantis of Florida here. And she said this, and this is a quote, "To say there were slaves is one thing, but to talk in detail about how slaves were treated and with photos is another." Because so, you know, the sanitized view of slavery in this country. And it's just incredible because, you know, yeah, I mean, to just say yes, and there were enslaved peoples in the United States. Great. That doesn't necessarily make people uncomfortable. But to say, do you know what the, you know, the passage was like? Do you know what slavery was like? Do you know, you know, and it's not all Martin Luther King Jr. It's a whole lot of other stuff that was going on and is still going on. So that's my final comment. Dave, why don't you do it? And then we'll let Beth have the final word here.
Yeah, the quote, I think that one of the things that the way we get through this and out of this, but it's a continuous topic that's been through all of these, which is if we believe in the role of expertise and preparation training and the idea that, you know, librarians have a different place than simply making sure the books are bought or not bought or put on shelf or not, but are actually active in talking about the curriculum. How do we expose this? How do we create a diverse conversation, an inclusive conversation? Then we need to support them. And so my quote will once again come from Christian, who said, "If you care about libraries, stop making speeches and pay the fucking librarians." That we need to understand that this is an interesting topic, but this is causing trauma, causing real problems for frontline school librarians, public librarians. We're dealing this on a regular basis, and they need the support. But I want to just give a tip of this entire conversation to Beth as I hand it off to her, because I mean, she has it right, which is banning and burning books. That's lovely. But what we're really talking about is who's allowed to feel uncomfortable and who's not allowed to feel uncomfortable and who's allowed to participate in that conversation. So Beth, take us away.
Are we ending every segment with a quote now? Did I miss a memo?
You missed the memo. You didn't get that?
Y'all. Well,
I'm
not good at e-reading emails, so it's very possible I missed that. Well, you know, I'm tongue-tied a bit. The idea that, like, we can acknowledge that we had slaves, but like, we don't want to get into the detail. But, and what I'd say, Mike, and you hinted at this at the end, is what we really don't want to talk about is how that keeps our country and our people down still today. Because if that was actually over, if the repercussions of slavery were over, then we could all probably have an easier conversation about this. But it's not. And so we won't revisit this. And that, I think, is the uncomfortable ness is that this it didn't happen 400 years ago, is that we're all watching this in our communities today. And that makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, we will end quote. That's right. And that was Beth Potanth, assistant professor at Syracuse University. And you can quote her. So we're going to take a short break. That was a great conversation. We will probably pick up this topic again, maybe even soon, maybe with somebody on the front lines. Hint, hint, hint.
Yep.
And we're going to take a short break and come back with our required awesome library thingy segment. So, Yanni, take us away with a little musical interlude. Go. Okay, we are back with our final required segment called the Awesome Library Thingy. Beth, what is your awesome library thingy for this episode?
So I want to give a shout out to the McMinn County Public Librarians in Tennessee, who are at the forefront of pushing back against the school board removing mouse from the curriculum. I think for all of the reasons y'all mentioned, that this is about their livelihood, this is about their community, they are experiencing or have the potential to experience real harassment, right? And so just really giving them all of the encouragement, but also, Dave, in a really real way, you know, advocating for them to get paid more so that they can continue to do this work, so that we can value these members of our communities even more. Dave, how about you?
I'm trying to.
Did I steal yours? Given this one.
No, but I'd love yours. Yours is great. I think I've said it before, but I'm going to say it again because they deserve as many times as I can. The Pottsboro Public Library in Pottsboro, Texas. I actually went up there. I visited. I looked around. They have a 50-foot antenna in the back parking lot where they're broadcasting broadband wireless to all the houses within a mile radius. They have a service population of 3,500 people. They have an esports team that is paired with a local college. They have now hiring digital navigators to sit down with primarily seniors, but anyone who needs help with their laptops and make appointments and how does this work and what's the phone and all this other bit. They have 3D, and they have VR headsets, they have Lego sets, and it's all in the size of a post office, an old post office. And the head librarian there, Diane Conroy, is amazing. And she's, by the way, not even paid because they couldn't afford her, so she's doing it for free. She gets paid because she writes grants and such. But she also said, I'm paid so that if any of this foolishness ever comes up, I can simply walk away. But it's to me, it is one of the most innovative public libraries I have seen, period, enough said, done, of any size in any place. And the fact that, you know, a lot of times when you talk about, well, all this community engagement stuff and, oh, all this technology, and that's great for bigger places that can afford it, et cetera. And no, it can happen. And in fact, it helps to know 3,500 people where you can almost know them all by name and make it happen. And I just, it's to me a brilliant, brilliant example of a community-based library who, where the librarian is trusted by the community, they work together and they're pushing together in the same way, which is ultimately, I think, the building this level of trust within the community, not just within the librarian, but within the whole community, is the ultimate answer to the censorship question that we just talked about. How about you, Mike?
Well, I'm going to give a shout out to the library field who's pushing back on these thing called First Amendment audits. I don't know if you guys have read your American libraries for January and February. There's an article in the uptick in First Amendment audits. A First Amendment audit is when some provocateur takes his video camera and goes into a public space, like even a police station or a library, and starts to record things, hoping that people will somehow try to shut them up or turn them, you know, away or create a controversy so that they can claim that their First Amendment rights have been harmed. And the American Library's article doesn't quite explain it as simply as that, but it's a very good piece on what these things are, and they are happening. And there's an uptick in cases according to ALA, and they're called First Amendment audits. What's happening is these videographers, if I can be nice to them, are trying to audit whether how these public places handle someone who is exercising their rights to video a public place. Now, of course, there aren't unlimited rights to video in a public place. You're not supposed to video children. You're not supposed to video the screens that people are using in computers. And there's a number of other things. And the way that the libraries are encouraged to push back is, again, to have a clear policy and procedure on how to deal with this, not to confront. Don't call the police immediately, because when that happens, that's exactly when they want, particularly if the police come in heavy-handed and push back, because they want their videos to go viral. If nobody makes a big deal about it, and then the librarian speaks in a very quiet way and just does point out when they're not supposed to or they shouldn't, they go away because they want and thrive on controversy. And so I thought this was an appropriate, awesome library thingy for the for librarians to be aware of and the public to be aware of, police, fire, even in schools to a certain degree, that these things are happening. Again, they're organized. There's a certain group who, and they're also trying to create viral videos that somehow get them lots of looks so they can make money on things like YouTube and Twitter and Facebook. So that is my awesome library thingy for this episode.
Repeat after me. A public library is not a public space. It is a civic space and therefore regulated as any other governmental institution owned and directed by the people, not simply a free-for-all. Anyway, so that brings us to conclusion. You're welcome. It's always good to get a lecture out to my old professor. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you. I particularly want to thank Mike and Beth this week because we'll see if it makes it in, but we had a great conversation talking about what do we do about this, and it's good to have friends. Thank you all, but Alpha, thank you for listening, and we want to hear from you as well. Thanks to Yanni from Ace Chicago Events, our producer and sound guru. Ace Chicago Events for production services, including sound, lighting, photo booths in the Chicago area, or online virtual streaming anywhere, acechicagoevents.com. Thanks to the iSchools at the University of Texas and at Syracuse for support. And please subscribe to us and rate us on Apple, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. And Benay Brown is back on Spotify, so I think it's okay again. Please share a review. Very important to get the word out. Contact us via email at info@librarieslead.org or Facebook group, where you can simply shout into your smart assistant and it will find us magically. Anyway, our Facebook group is Libraries Lead in the New Normal. Our website is www.librarieslead.org. We are about to play out music for 30 seconds and ending. And once again, thank you all very much.
Bye, Dave. Bye, Beth. Thank you.